You're listening to District Sentinel Radio. It's that daily newscast featuring reporting from the left. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're broadcasting out of the Sentinel Fort in Washington, D.C. Happy May Day, folks. It's International Workers' Day. So we're going to bring you a special episode today.
Yeah, we're putting out Sentinel Radio early today so we can celebrate. I'm going downtown. I think Sam is just going to take the day off like workers should do more, really.
Yeah, I'll express my solidarity on Twitter all day. So no newscast, but we have a special interview coming up that we'll get into in just a moment. But first, a bit of a weird weekend that we got to tell our listeners about, since I think they actually care about this stuff and all.
Yeah.
Not many of my non-Twitter friends would care about this, but you listeners would. Sam and I basically partied with Sally Albright over the weekend on Saturday night.
It was wild. We were invited to the Young Turks White House, or sorry, the Watchdog Correspondents' Dinner.
Yeah, it's basically the Young Turks White House Correspondents' Party.
It was a great party. It was fantastic.
It was across the street from the Hinckley Hilton, where the real White House Correspondents' Dinner Association is held.
Yeah, and it was a fantastic party. I'm super happy that I was there. TYT did a great job putting it on.
Yeah, hung out with some Intercept folks.
Yeah. The other people were there too, but it was just the dangdest thing in the world because in walks Sally Albright.
Yeah, I believe you said, I think that's Sally, at which point I was like, it could be. I don't think so. Then we saw her talking to Tommy Christopher, in which I was like, all right, I think that actually is Sally. And then I heard Tommy introduce her as Sally.
And
sure enough, it was Sally Albright.
And I didn't know at the time who Tommy was, but he's a Cher Blue guy.
Yeah.
And he wears some really dumb hat in his profile pic. Well, guess what? He was wearing the hat in real life, too.
Yeah.
But it was really bizarre and kind of sad, really, to have such an angry shit poster like Sally, who's just constantly railing about how Bernie bros are racist and this and that, and they're the worst thing ever. Guess who was there fucking partying all night with Sally? It was pathetic.
Yeah.
She didn't have anything
better
to do. She's a
real person. I was surprised she was actually a real person, to be honest. Now that I've seen her, you know, in the flesh, Sally's real.
Yeah, she is.
And I think she actually holds those opinions because there was some sort of back and forth later in the night in which she sort of like realized that people were onto the fact that Sally Albright is at this party.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad I didn't actually go up to her and say, like, why are you here? You should leave.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, the growing chorus of laughs
I will say you restrained yourself pretty well by not tweeting about it in the moment. Instead, you managed to tweet out hot pictures of yourself in a suit.
And you, actually. I tweeted out a picture of you.
That's true. Also, shout out to Hamid with Our Revolution. Cool to kick it with him. He got to experience what it's like to play the two Sams in pool. He got dominated. And by dominated, I mean that Hamid's teammates scratched on the eight ball. So we won. But a win is a win, baby.
Count it. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. I would hope that the same happens to my... sorry, I'm just stressed about hockey. The Caps are playing tonight.
Oh, yeah.
They're probably... It's not looking good. They're down 2-0 to Pittsburgh. It's not looking good.
That is not looking good. But they're coming back home, right? Or no, they've been on the road. No. They lost two at home.
They lost two at home. They're going to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that does not look good. Okay, enough about the weekend. Let's get to work here. What's coming up on this show, Sam?
Well, given that this is May Day... In the spirit of worldwide solidarity, we thought it would be a good time to take a closer look at what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. The Trump administration is threatening to carry out preemptive strikes on North Korea in response to its nuclear tests. But what do South Koreans think about this ratcheting up of tensions by the White House? So last night, we called up Tim Shirok to find out. Tim is a journalist who has lived in South Korea, and he has covered Korean politics for 35 years. You may have read a piece by him recently in The Nation. And we reached out to him where he is currently in Gwangju. Take a listen.
People here in South Korea, by far, are more concerned with what Trump might do than anything North Korea might do. They see it primarily as a fight between the U.S. and North Korea. They know that Trump has been ratcheting up the tensions himself. and they know that North Korea has been ratcheting up the tensions, but there really is very little concern that there's going to be a war. And, you know, in fact, you know, there's, you know, as you know, there's an election coming up on May 9th, very important election, the snap election, because the last president was kicked out of office and has been spending time in jail, in fact, after she was forced out. And so the president, the guy who's going to probably win, Moon Jae-in, has proposed a ratcheting down of tensions and wants South Korea to take the lead in negotiating, and wants to get back to the days when there was economic and political cooperation between North and South Korea, starting with some economic projects. So I think the feeling here is that, you know, crisis, so-called, you know, can be averted by having negotiations and starting a sort of a peace process. So they see it as mostly between the U.S. and North Korea.
It's pretty astonishing to hear what the feeling is on the ground there when considering that Trump and Republicans act like they're doing the South Koreans a huge favor. And
right, exactly.
And this came up recently with, it's obviously come up in a lot of different ways, but with the deployment of the THAAD.
Yes, well, this is the anti-missile, you know, defense system that a lot of people here don't think is really going to work anyway. But it's created a lot of tensions with China. And the thing is, people here have felt, and including several of the candidates who are running for president, have felt that the decision to bring THAAD here, they allow the U.S. to bring THAAD here, was made by the last government, by the Park Geun-hye government. And they see that government is now completely illegitimate. She was impeached for a variety of reasons, including, corruption, abuse of power. And they think she made the wrong decision. They would like the new government to make the decision to whether to deploy the THAAD batteries or not. And so, you know, a few days ago, the U.S. unilaterally deployed the first battery, and they brought it, you know, they had trucks, and they brought it to this town where there's a big golf course owned by a big Korean conglomerate that's donated its land for the use of these anti-missile batteries. And there was hundreds and hundreds of people in the town, turned out. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning when they did this. There was riot police, you know, beating people up. Many old people in this town were getting beaten. Yes. And so there was front page stories in the Korean press. Every Korean newspaper had this on the front page, of these grinning American soldiers in these vehicles, you know, imposing, you know, these THAAD anti-missile batteries on this town and on Korea. And it's really created a lot of anger. And, you know, there were signs saying, you know, do you think we're a colony? And I have actually not seen such strong anti-American sentiment toward American forces here for years, decades. You know, I would say go back to the days of Gwangju, the early 1980s, when there was so much anger at the U.S. And so Trump has really blown it in terms of, like, this is supposed to be a very close ally. He's also made other, you know, ridiculous statements, such as, you know, tweeting that, Korea was part of China, which it never was. And then also, after this happened, this forced deployment happened, he said South Korea is going to pay for it, for each battery, $1 billion each. And this raised the temperature even more. It made people even more angry. And then, you know, the other day, I guess it was on Sunday, McMaster, the National Security Council, had to hurriedly call the South Korean equivalent and say, no, you're not going to have to pay for it. We'll pay for it. And, you know, actually, openly contradicted President Trump. So it's people are kind of like shaking their heads, like, you know, who's in charge here and what are they doing? And there's a lot of anger.
It sounds like a huge subsidy, basically, that the Trump administration is just trying to, give a shot in the arm to the arms industry in the U.S. by not only doing this, also trying to make Korea pay for it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the ratcheting of the tensions is definitely, I mean, actually, you know, I've talked to people here who are like professors and, you know, people who have, you know, observed the situation. situation for many years, and they think that, you know, it's part of the way to build up the military-industrial complex in the U.S., keep North Korea up as a threat. You know, I mean, the thing is that what the press, you know, 99% of the U.S. press coverage is just terrible. I mean, it reminds me of, like, you know, when, you know, remember the Maine in 1898 when, you know, we went to war with Spain, right? This fervor for war in the U.S. media is just unbelievable. And you see it on almost every, you know, CNN, MSNBC, everywhere. It's just like, you know, when are we going to go to war and what will happen if we go to war? Well, the fact is, North Korea has been building nuclear weapons and testing missiles because they fear they feel that their sovereignty and actual, you know, survival is at stake. They look at places like Libya, Iraq, Iran, and see that, you know, countries that didn't have nuclear weapons didn't do so well in terms of U.S. threats. And so this is a way they see to defend themselves. And until that, you know, the issue was addressed, they're going to continue doing it. And that's why I think, you know, I've been saying for years, the only way out of this is to have, you know, direct negotiations, you know, some kind of peace negotiations, because a lot of people forget that the Korean War never really ended. It ended in an armistice in 1953, which just means, you know, people put down their guns. But there's never been a peace treaty. There was supposed to be a peace treaty, but it never happened. And so, you know, taking steps to go toward a peace treaty, de-escalating first and then opening negotiations, that's a first step. But it can only be done with talks. It's not going to be done through military might, no matter how much, you know, Trump thinks he's going to flex American, you know, military muscles and sending these, you know, aircraft carrier groups and nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed submarines here. It's just that's not going to resolve the problem. It's making it worse.
Well, the Trump administration did float the idea of direct talks with North Korea last week, but only after the government ceases its nuclear program. You talked about the media frenzy here in the U.S. Part of what fuels that is the character that we know of, Kim Jong-un. Here in the U.S., he's depicted as kind of a mysterious, maybe, or even from that end, from mysterious, we don't know anything about him, all the way to he's a psychopath who kills people with anti-aircraft guns, which, you know, that seems to be a myth that's, like, spread around all the time. I'm curious how he's depicted in South Korea. You talked about how Trump is the guy that people are afraid of earlier. I mean, is Kim Jong-un just kind of, you know, so a known quantity more so in South Korea than he is here?
Well, you know, the Kim dynasty is very familiar to people here. You know, people who are older remember his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, and then Kim Jong-il, and then Kim Jong-un. So that's not, you know, a big shock to people, nor is it a big shock about how he looks, you know, and this kind of thing. I mean, there's a kind of racist element, I think, to a lot of the way he's portrayed in the United States, which is not to say that this is North Korea is obviously an extremely authoritarian state. They execute people that they believe are, you know, enemies of the people, and, you know, that happens quite a bit. Although, there's often exaggerated reports about, who's been executed and not. You know, there's been wild reports about certain people being executed, and then, you know, 3 months later they appear at a military parade. And in fact, you know, 2 weeks ago they had their national, they celebrated the birthday of Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, and they had this big military parade, of course, which was shown over and over again on American television to show how menacing they were. And there was a general on the reviewing stand who was reported, you know, a few months ago as having been purged and executed. So a lot of these reports are just simply not true. Sometimes they're fabrications by South Korean intelligence. So there's this kind of, you know, intelligence war going on at the same time. But, you know, he does have a tremendous amount of power. He's backed by this very strong military, and they put a huge amount of their resources into military. And they have this line in their political line, which is that the nuclear weapons development and military development go hand in hand. That's part of their economic development. And so, like, when the U.S. says we're not going to talk to you unless you give up all your nukes and missiles first, that's a total non-starter. I mean, that's like saying basically we're not going to talk. And I think that, you know, there's been proposals floated. I actually posted this morning on Facebook an interview that was done with Donald Gregg, who is at one point he was the CIA station chief in Seoul during the 70s. And he's been very involved in Korean affairs since leaving government. And, you know, he was a national security advisor to George H.W. Bush at one point. But he's actually been very adamant about the need for engagement with North Korea. And he actually met with North Korean diplomats in New York a couple of weeks ago. And they told him they were very confused about the mixed signals coming from the Trump administration. You know, war on one hand and maybe not, maybe negotiations on the other. But they were also, I think there's been a certain openness. American officials who've been here, been to North Korea, have said there's an openness to having some kind of moratorium on, you know, missile testing and nuclear weapons testing, and more animate moratorium on this side of these massive U.S., South Korean, Japanese military exercises that go on almost all through the year. If there could be a moratorium on that, that might be a basis for some discussions leading towards talks about a peace treaty and then possibly eventual nuclearization. But it's possible that there may not be able to have an agreement without, I mean, North Korea may remain a nuclear power. And if they're determined to stop that at all costs, then there could be a war.
Well, that's going to be my next question here is, Trump has seen the sort of positive coverage he received when he went and launched strikes against the Assad regime in Syria, when he dropped the Moab in Afghanistan. This is a president who has the lowest poll numbers of any president at this point. So the frightening prospect is that he will start, or at least take a preemptive strike against North Korea, given the positive reinforcement he's received for that behavior. What are the consequences of a preemptive strike by the U.S. on North Korea for the region, for South Korea?
It would be a catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people would die. I mean, the North Koreans have a massive amount of artillery, conventional weapons, you know, near the border with South Korea, near the DMZ, and those, and they now have missiles that can reach Japan. They don't have the ability to put a nuclear weapon on any of their missiles, but they could conceivably, you know, launch attacks on U.S. bases in Japan and U.S. bases here. But I mean, there would be an immediate retaliation if they attacked North Korea. That would start a war, and I think ironically, one of the factors, you know, holding Trump back may be the Pentagon. I mean, the Pentagon itself, people in the military who've served here, have been in the Army here, and were the Air Force, know what a war would mean in terms of another war in the Korean Peninsula. It would be massive. And it would involve, you know, they would have to, focus all U.S. military force here again. I mean, it would kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. So I think it would just be a catastrophe. And, you know, when Trump swaggers and said, you know, well, maybe there's going to be a big, big war. I mean, I don't think he has any idea of what that would mean. I mean, Seoul is only like 30 miles south of the DMZ, and Seoul's a huge, huge city. But like I said at the beginning, you know, amazingly enough, you know, people here are just not that concerned. I mean, you know, this isn't just me saying that. If you read the Wall Street Journal, like, they had a pretty good bureau in Seoul, and about a week ago or so, they had a report about, you know, people just sort of taking this in as like another rite of spring, you know, the North Korean bluster and U.S. bluster, and they're kind of used to it, and they've seen these kind of crises, you know, come and go, and they just don't think, you know, North Korea, an attack by North Korea first, a preemptive strike on anybody and, you know, any U.S. forces and or on South Korea would be suicide for them. And North Korea knows that. It would be suicide. I mean, because they would get smashed in return. So I think, you know, like, there's this, that's the scare factor, is that, you know, the damage would be, the consequences would be terrible and enormous.
Yeah, I totally buy into that scare factor. I'm not sure I'm as confident that the generals would prevent something like that. We saw some testimony just yesterday with the head of Pacific Command.
Last week.
Admiral Harry Harrison,
yeah.
In which Lindsey Graham is talking to him, trying to kind of assuage the concerns of the North Korean government, being like, we're not looking to invade North Korea just willy-nilly tomorrow. And Harrison says, well, I don't want to take anything off the table. They've provoked us. They sound like they're more than ready to go ahead with it. I don't know if they're as rational as we might give them credit for.
That's what, you know, those top generals will say. But I mean, people who have experience here, I mean, there are still people not necessarily working anymore within the military, within the Pentagon, who are in the Korean War, but they know it. They studied the history. They know the history. You know, the Marines, the U.S. Marines had one of their worst defeats ever in Korea during the Korean War. I mean, during the Korean War, you know, after the North Koreans tried to liberate the whole country, invaded the South, and then, you know, a few months later, General MacArthur did his famous invasion at Incheon, and, you know, U.S. forces came in and pushed the North Koreans north of the border. They made a decision, a very fateful decision. President Truman was part of this decision to keep on going, and they crossed the 38th parallel and went and invaded North Korea, and they tried to, you know, they tried to occupy the whole country, and the Chinese came in the September, October of 1950, and that winter, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of Chinese came in. By that time, the Marines were way, very far north. They were completely surrounded, and, you know, it's called the Chosin Reservoir. I mean, it's this terrible, terrible battle, and, you know, tens of thousands of people, of Americans, were killed, frozen to death, and they had to retreat, and they retreated and, you know, went to the port, North Korean port of Wonsan, where they were pulled out. But they know what a land war in Korea would look like, and they know also with the advanced weaponry that both sides have, that the destruction would be far worse. But, you know, as many people who understand the history here of the war know, North Korea was completely destroyed in the Korean War. I mean, there was nothing left to bomb. Curtis LeMay, who, you know, bombed Japan and, you know, destroyed, you know, dozens of Japanese cities, did the same thing in North Korea. All that was left, I mean, there's nothing left but cinders in North Korea. And, you know, there's still people in the North Korean army that were part of that and know what happened. And, you know, that's why, you know, there's this great fear in North Korea of what the United States could do. So I do think that there is a certain kind of, you know, reluctance on the U.S. military to get involved, but it's not going to restrain Trump if he wants to do it. So what's going to restrain Trump? I'm not sure. We certainly have seen no courage whatsoever from any American, you know, lawmakers on the issue of Korea. I've been very disappointed that Bernie Sanders has come out and said things, you know, like Trump is doing the right thing in Korea. I think that's disgraceful. I mean, where is the moral voice of someone like Senator McGovern or Senator Eugene McCarthy during the Vietnam War saying, you know, let's look at the whole history here. Let's look at what the United States does and what the purpose of this is, and let's look at what the other side wants. You know, let's look at the facts here. Nobody seems to be willing to do that in the Congress. And what's his name, the senator from South Carolina you just mentioned?
Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham, I mean, he said something about, you know, well, yeah, war would be terrible for South Korea, Japan, you know, nearby countries, but, you know, that's the price we pay, you know, that's the way it goes, kind of.
Yeah, he said something like, oh, but the war would be over there, it wouldn't be over here, I believe what he said. Pretty callous.
Extremely callous.
Yeah.
And also, doesn't he remember that there's 26,000 American soldiers stationed here?
Yeah, apparently, and more in Japan as well.
I mean, it's really disgusting to hear that kind of language. Yeah. And also, I find it appalling just to see the press, the majority of the press, kind of go on with this and not even talk about what the impact of a war would be. The other great, you know, missing part of this is, you know, it's like you know, Trump, you know, when there was this missile test when, you know, the Japanese Prime Minister Abe was in Mar-a-Lago and meeting with Trump, and that famous, you know, incident when the North Koreans shot off the missiles and Trump was looking at his classified information on his phone in front of all these cameras, where Abe was there. And so, like, you know, he makes a big deal out of it. We're going to deal work with Japan on this. And then, of course, he's been talking about, you know, the Chinese leader Xi, and now we're so tight with China now. China's helping us. It's almost like South Korea is doesn't even exist. South Korea is just a side thought, you know. And you know, South Korea is its own country. There are 50 million people here, and they feel that, you know, this is their country. North and South Korea are part of the same nation, and you know, they want to have peace here. They don't want to have war, and it's like, the United States government and the media just completely ignores South Korea. It's like, you know, they're our colony. They'll do whatever we want them to do. This seems to be the thinking.
I want to ask one more question about that, about ignoring Korea, as it were. As you mentioned, a dovish candidate could possibly win the election in about 8 days' time. Would that possibly, if there was such a result, would that possibly force Trump back from the ledge, as it were, do you think?
Well, I think they will be forced to reckon with that president. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be Moon Jae-in, who is the leading candidate. And he's been the most, you know, forceful critic of Trump on the issue of that and some other issues. There's a more left candidate running, but she doesn't have much of a chance, and so Moon has been leading the polls and actually pulling ahead. And you know, his thing is, you know, in the 1990s, late 1990s, the famous Korean opposition leader Kim Dae-jung was elected president, and then he was followed by one of his, you know, someone who was close to him, who was also a progressive on the left, Nomu Hyun, and they both carried out what Kim Dae-jung's policy was the Sunshine Policy, but they had, you know, increased economic and cultural ties with North Korea as a way to diffuse the tensions. And in that period, actually, you know, there was a lot of interaction between North and South Korea. And Moon Jae-in was a top aide to Nomu Hyun. He was his top national security aide during that presidency. And when he actually spoke down here in Gwangju a couple of weeks ago, and I heard him speak. And you know, during the rally, he held up a big picture of Kim Dae-jung and Nomu Hyun, and he made it very clear that he wants to go back to that kind of policy. And so I think there's going to actually be, if he's elected president, which I think he's going to be, I think Trump's advisors, people like McMaster and whoever else is giving him advice there, are going to say, you know, well, we've got to, you know, give some legitimacy and some credence to what this new Korean leader wants to do. And I think, and if the new Korean leader can make, you know, some progress in talking with the North or talking with Kim Jong-un government, I think that would make a big change. But, you know, who knows? I mean, it's very hard to predict, but I do predict that there's going to be a considerable amount of tension between the new South Korean government and the Trump administration about how to proceed with North Korea. Because, you know, when Trump was talking about, like, these, you know, preemptive strikes, the politicians across the board, even the right-wing politicians here, were, like, very upset and angry that there had been no consultation with South Korea about that. They were saying, look, you know, if there's going to be a preemptive strike, we damn well better know about it and indeed, you know, have some discussions with us beforehand. So, you know, I think there is a certain kind of, you know, counter pressure in South Korea against what Trump wants to do. And I have to tell you, myself and other Americans I know here have been getting calls from family. I've gotten my 93-year-old dad is very, you know, he watches CNN. I keep telling him to stop watching CNN, but I think there's going to be a war tomorrow, you know? And that's the way CNN makes it seem. It's almost hysterical reporting. And so, like I say, you know, are you sure you want to? I mean, I've got emails from people, you better leave and all this kind of thing. And I'm like, look, you know, people here in South Korea are just not concerned.
Well, I watched too much cable news, Tim. That's why I asked you at the top if you were hiding in bunkers, because I've been watching too much cable news myself. But, hey, this interview is coming out on May Day, which we don't celebrate here in the U.S.
We kind of do.
Institutionally.
Institutionally, we don't. It's Loyalty Day here.
Yeah. What are your May Day plans today?
Well, actually, I'm working here at the archive. I'm using it as a day to keep going on my work. And you know, as I'm, you know, my focus is, you know, all my documents are talking about the U.S. role in South Korea in 1979 and 1980 when there was this rolling coup and this terrible massacre here in Kwangju. And so, you know, I've had my documents for some time, but I have some new documents too. And so, I'm just documenting, you know, the U.S. role at the time of 1980. The U.S. There was an uprising here against, you know, when people rose up against the brutality of the Korean martial law forces. The U.S. sided with the Korean martial law forces, and they used military force to put down the uprising. And to me, that was the worst mistake the United States ever made in South Korea in the years since the Korean War. And so I'm still working on that, and that gets a lot of attention here. Just the other night, I was on the equivalent of South Korea's 60 Minutes. There's a channel here that has an investigative show, and they did a big documentary on the Kwangju Uprising, which is seen as the seed of the democratic movement here, which, as you know, in 1987, they finally won their democracy here, but it was after years and years of struggle against a dictatorship that was, you know, a very close ally of the United States.
Well, we'll have to bring you on again in the not-so-distant future for a deeper dive onto those issues as well. Tim Sharrock, thanks for being our guy on the ground in South Korea for the last half hour here.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the call and really appreciate being on your show.
Thanks again to Tim. Follow him on Twitter, @TimothySS. And that is the show today. Listeners, call our rant line, leave a message. That number is 202-684-6108. Sponsors of the show include the Congressional Dish podcast, hosted by Jennifer Briney. Check it out at congressionaldish.com. Another sponsor, levelnews.org. Listen to this episode and all other episodes of our nightly newscast by going to districtsentinel.com. If you haven't yet, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud by searching for District Sentinel Radio.
Also, tune in and Stitcher Radio, baby. We are on there too.
Leave us a review, give us a rating, tell your friends to listen. Special thanks to all our subscribers on Patreon. We've got a new month kicking up starting today. Good time to start contributing once again to get our weekly podcast, the Sentinel Cast. Last week we had comedian Kath Barbadoro and reporter Paul Blumenthal. It was a good show.
Yeah, and we will be planning to do our live shows pretty soon. Hopefully we will have something for you in the next few weeks about where we're going to be and the times, etc.
Yeah, stay tuned for announcements. We're back tomorrow. We're in D.C., so you don't have to be.